Maybe the suave ski instructor who turned out to be an assassin.
Hey, pretty lady. He kissed Gladys on the cheek. And you've got Luke.
Hi, Luke.
He stuck out his hand.
Luke, channeling Nikki Wilholm, didn't shake it. Tony laughed as though this were a particularly good joke.
Come in. Come in.
The invitation was just for him, it seemed. Gladys gave him a little push on the shoulder and closed the door. What Luke saw in the middle of the room was alarming. It looked like a dentist chair, except he'd never seen one that had straps on the arms.
Sit down, champ, Tony said.
Not sport, Luke thought, but close. Tony went to a counter, opened a drawer beneath, and rummaged in it. He was whistling. When he turned around, he had something that looked like a small soldering gun in one hand. He seemed surprised to see Luke still standing inside the door. Tony grinned.
Sit down, I said.
What are you going to do with that?
Tattoo me? He thought of Jews getting numbers tattooed on their arms when they entered the camps at Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen. That should have been a totally ridiculous idea, but... Tony looked surprised, then laughed.
Gosh, no. I'm just going to chip your earlobe. It's like getting pierced for an earring. No big deal. And all our guests get 'em.
I'm no guest, Luke said, backing up. I'm a prisoner, and you're not putting anything in my ear.
I am, though, Tony said, still grinning.
Still looking like the guy who would help little kids on the bunny slopes before trying to kill James Bond with a poison dart.
Look, it's no more than a pinch.
So make it easy on both of us. Sit in the chair, it'll be over in 7 seconds. Gladys will give you a bunch of tokens when you leave.
Make it hard, and you still get the chip, but no tokens. What do you say?
I'm not sitting in that chair.
Luke felt trembly all over, but his voice sounded strong enough. Tony sighed. He set the chip insertion gadget carefully on the counter, walked to where Luke stood, and put his hands on his hips. Now he looked solemn, almost sorrowful.
Are you sure?
Yes.
His ears were ringing from the open-handed slap almost before he was aware Tony's right hand had left his hip. Luke staggered back a step and stared at the big man with wide, stunned eyes. His father had paddled him once gently for playing with matches when he was 4 or 5, but he had never been slapped in the face before. His cheek was burning, and he still couldn't believe it had happened.
That hurt a lot more than an earlobe pinch, Tony said. The grin was gone.
Want another?
Happy to oblige. You kids who think you own the world. Man, oh man.
For the first time, Luke noticed there was a small blue bruise on Tony's chin and a small cut on his left jaw. He thought of the fresh bruise on Nikki Wilholm's face. He wished he had the guts to do the same, but he didn't. The truth was, he didn't know how to fight. If he tried, Tony would probably slap him all over the room.
You ready to get in the chair?
Luke got in the chair.
Are you going to behave, or do I need the straps?
I'll behave.
He did, and Tony was right. The earlobe pinch wasn't as bad as the slap, possibly because he was ready for it, possibly because it felt like a medical procedure rather than an assault. When it was done, Tony went to a sterilizer and produced a hypodermic needle.
Round 2, champ.
What's in that?
Luke asked.
None of your beeswax?
If it's going into me, it is my beeswax.
Tony sighed.
Straps or no straps?
Your choice. He thought of George saying, pick your battles.
No straps.
Good lad. Just a little sting and done.
It was more than a little sting.
Not agony,
but a pretty big sting just the same. Luke's arm went hot all the way down to his wrist, as if he had a fever in that one part of him. Then it felt normal again. Tony put on a Band-Aid clear spot, then swiveled the chair so it faced a white wall.
Now close your eyes.
Luke closed them.
Do you hear anything?
Like what?
Stop asking questions and answer mine. Do you hear anything?
Be quiet and let me listen.
Tony was quiet. Luke listened. Someone walked by out there in the hall, and someone laughed. I think it was Gladys.
Nothing else?
No.
Okay, you're doing good. Now I want you to count to 20, then open your eyes.
Luke counted and opened.
What do you see?
The wall.
Nothing else?
Luke thought Tony almost had to be talking about the dots. When you see 'em, say so, George had told him. When you don't, say that. Don't lie. They know. Nothing else.
Sure?
Yes.
Tony slapped him on the back, making Luke jump. Okay, champ, we're done here. I'll give you some ice for that ear.
You have yourself a great day.
8.
Gladys was waiting for him when Tony showed him out of room B31. She was smiling her cheerful, professional hostess smile.
How did you do, Luke?
Tony answered for him.
He did fine. Good kid.
It's what we specialize in,
Gladys almost sang.
Have a good day, Tony.
You too, Glad.
She led Luke back to the elevator, chattering away merrily. He had no idea what she was talking about. His arm only hurt a little, but he was holding the cold pack to his ear, which throbbed. The slap had been worse than either, for all kinds of reasons. Gladys escorted him to his room along the industrial green corridor, past the poster Kalisha had been sitting under, past the one reading Just Another Day in Paradise, and finally to the room that looked like his room, but wasn't.
Free time,
she cried, as if conferring a prize of great worth. Right now, the prospect of being alone did feel like a sort of prize.
He gave you a shot, right?
Yes.
If your arm starts to hurt, or if you feel faint, tell me you're one of the other caretakers, okay?
Okay. He opened the door, but before he could go in, Gladys grabbed him by the shoulder and turned him around. She was still smiling the hostess smile, but her fingers were steely, pressing into his flesh, not quite hard enough to hurt, but hard enough to let him know they could hurt.
No tokens, I'm afraid,
she said.
I didn't need to discuss it with Tony. That mark on your cheek tells me all I need to know.
Luke wanted to say, I don't want any of your shitty tokens, but kept silent. It wasn't a slap he was afraid of. He was afraid that the sound of his own voice, weak, unsteady, bewildered, the voice of a 6-year-old, would cause him to break down in front of her.
Let me give you some advice, she said,
not smiling now.
You need to realize that you are here to serve, Luke. That means you have to grow up fast. It means being realistic. Things will happen to you here. Some of them will not be so nice. You can be a good sport about them and get tokens, or you can be a bad sport and get none. Those things will happen either way, so which should you choose? It shouldn't be hard to figure out.
Luke made no reply. Her smile came back, nevertheless. The hostess smile that said,
Oh, yes, sir, I'll show you to your table right away. You'll be back home before the summer is over, and it will be like none of this happened. If you remember it all, it will be like a dream. But while it's not a dream, why not make your stay a happy one?
She relaxed her grip and gave him a gentle push.
You should rest a bit, I think. Lie down. Did you see the dots?
No.
You will.
She closed the door, very gently. Luke sleepwalked across the room to the bed that wasn't his bed. He lay down, put his head on the pillow that wasn't his pillow, and stared at the blank wall where there was no window. No dots, either. Whatever they were. He thought, I want my mom. Oh, God, I want my mom so bad. That broke him. He dropped the cold pack, cupped his hands over his eyes, and began crying. Were they watching him? Were listening to his sobs? It didn't matter. He was past caring. He was still crying when he fell asleep.
9.
He woke up feeling better, cleaned out somehow. He saw two things had been added to his room while he was at lunch and then meeting his wonderful new friends, Gladys and Tony. There was a laptop on the desk. It was a Mac, like his, but an older model. The other addition was a small TV on a stand in the corner. He went to the computer first and powered it up, feeling another deep pang of homesickness at the familiar Macintosh chime. Instead of a password prompt, he got a blue screen with this message: "Show camera 1 token to open." Luke banged the return key a couple of times, knowing it would do no good. "You fucking thing." Then, in spite of how horrible and surreal all this was, he had to laugh. It was harsh and brief, but genuine. Had he felt a certain sense of superiority, maybe even contempt, at the idea of kids scrounging for tokens so they could buy wine coolers or cigarettes? Sure he had. Had he thought, "I'd never do that"? Sure he had. When Luke thought of kids who drank and smoked, which was rarely, he had more important things to consider. What came to mind were goth losers who listened to Pantera and drew lopsided devil horns on their denim jackets. Losers so dumb that they mistook wrapping themselves in the chains of addiction as an act of rebellion. He couldn't imagine doing either. But here he was, staring at a blank blue laptop screen and hitting the return key like a rat in a Skinner box banging the lever for a piece of kibble or a few grains of cocaine. He closed the laptop and grabbed the remote off the top of the television. He fully expected another blue screen and another message telling him he needed a token or tokens to operate it. But instead, he got Steve Harvey interviewing David Hasselhoff about the Hoff's bucket list. The audience was laughing it up at the Hoff's funny answers. Pushing the guide button on the remote produced a DirecTV menu similar to the one at home, but as with the room and the laptop, not quite the same. Although there was a wide selection of movies and sports programs, there were no network or news channels. Luke turned the set off, replaced the remote on top, and looked around. Other than the one leading to the corridor, there were two doors. One opened on a closet. There were jeans, t-shirts. No effort had been made to exactly copy the ones he had at home, which was sort of a relief. A couple of button-up shirts, two pairs of sneakers, and one pair of slippers. There were no hard shoes. The other door opened on a small, spandy-clean bathroom. There were a couple of toothbrushes, still in their cases, on the wash basin, next to a fresh tube of Crest. In the well-stocked medicine cabinet, he found mouthwash, a bottle of children's Tylenol with just 4 pills inside, deodorant, roll-on DEET bug spray, Band-Aids, and several other items, some more useful than others. The only thing that might be considered even remotely dangerous was a pair of nail clippers. He swung the medicine cabinet closed and looked at himself. His hair was crazied up, and there were dark circles, beat-off circles, Rolf would have called them, under his eyes. He looked both older and younger, which was weird. He peered at his tender right earlobe and saw one of those tiny metal circles embedded in the slightly reddened skin. He had no doubt that somewhere on B level, or C, or D, there was a computer tech who could now track his every movement. Was perhaps tracking him now. Lucas David Ellis, who had been planning to matriculate at MIT and Emerson, had been reduced to a blinking dot on a computer screen. Luke returned to his room. "The room," he told himself. "It's the room, not my room." Looked around and realized a dismaying thing. No books. Not a single one. That was as bad as no computer. Maybe worse. He went to the dresser and opened the drawers one by one, thinking he might at least find a Bible or a Book of Mormon, like they sometimes had in hotel rooms. He discovered only neat stacks of underwear and socks. What did that leave? Steve Harvey interviewing David Hasselhoff? Reruns of America's Funniest Home Videos? No. No way. He left the room thinking Kalisha or one of the other kids might be around. He found Maureen Alverson instead, trundling her Dandux laundry basket slowly down the corridor. It was heaped with folded sheets and towels. She looked more tired than ever and sounded out of breath. "Hello, Miss Alverson. Can I push that for you?"
"That would be kind," she said with a smile. "We've got 5 newbies coming in, 2 tonight and 3 tomorrow, and I've got to get the rooms ready. They're down that-a-way."
She pointed in the opposite direction from the lounge and the playground. He pushed the basket slowly, because she was walking slowly. "I don't suppose you know how I could earn a token, do you, Miss Alverson? I need one to unlock the computer in my room."
"Can you make a bed? If I stand by and give you instructions?"
"Sure. I make my bed at home."
"With hospital corners?"
"Well, no."
"Never mind, I'll show you. Make 5 beds for me and I'll give you 3 tokes. It's all I've got in my pocket. They keep me short."
"3 would be great."
"All right, but enough with the Ms. Alverson. You call me Maureen, or just Mo, same as the other kids."
"I can do that," Luke said. They went past the elevator annex and into the hallway beyond. It was lined with more inspirational posters. There was also an ice machine, like in a motel hallway, and it didn't appear to take tokens. Just past it, Maureen put a hand on Luke's arm. He stopped pushing the basket and looked at her inquiringly. When she spoke, it was just above a whisper.
"You got chipped, I see, but you didn't get any tokens."
"Well,
you can talk, as long as you keep your voice down. There's 6 places in front half where their damn microphones don't reach. Dead zones, and I know all of them. This is one, right by this ice machine."
"Okay.
Who did your chip and put that mark on your face? Was it Tony?"
Luke's eyes began to burn, and he didn't quite trust himself to speak, whether it was safe or not. He just nodded.
"He's one of the mean ones," Maureen said. "Zeke is another. So is Gladys, even though she smiles a lot. There are plenty of people working here who like pushing kids around, but those are 3 of the worst." "Tony slapped me," Luke whispered. "Hard."
She ruffled his hair. It was the kind of thing ladies did to babies and little kids, but Luke didn't mind. It was being touched with kindness, and right now that meant a lot. Right now, that meant everything.
"Do what he says," Maureen said. "Don't argue with him. That's my best advice. There's people you can argue with here. You can even argue with Mrs. Sixby. Much good it will do you. But Tony and Zeke are 2 bad bumblebees. Gladys, too. They sting."
She started down the corridor again, but Luke caught her by the sleeve of her brown uniform and tugged her back to the safe area.
"I think Nikki hit Tony," he whispered. "He had a cut and a mousy eye."
Maureen smiled, showing teeth that looked long overdue for dental work.
"Good for Nick," she said. "Tony probably paid him back double, but still, good. Now come on. With you to help me, we can get these rooms ready in a jiff."
The first one they visited had posters of Tommy Pickles and Zuko, Nickelodeon characters, on the walls, and a platoon of G.I. Joe action figures on the bureau. Luke recognized several of them right off the bat, having gone through his own G.I. Joe phase not all that long ago. The wallpaper featured happy clowns with balloons.
"Holy crap," Luke said. "This is a little kid's room."
She gave Luke an amused glance as if to say, "You're not exactly Methuselah."
"That's right. His name is Avery Dixon, and according to my sheet, he's just 10. Let's get to work. I bet I only have to show you how to do a hospital corner once. You look like a kid who catches on quick."
10. Back in his room, Luke held one of his tokens up to the laptop's camera. He felt a little stupid doing it, but the computer opened at once, first showing a blue screen with a message on it reading, "Welcome back, Donna." Luke frowned, then smiled a little. At some point before his arrival, this computer had belonged, or been on loan anyway, to someone named Donna. The welcome screen hadn't been changed yet, Someone had slipped up. Just a tiny slip, but where there was one, there might be others. The welcome message disappeared and a standard desktop photo appeared. A deserted beach under a dawn sky. The info strip at the bottom of the screen was like the one on his computer at home, with one glaring, but at this point unsurprising, difference. No little email postage stamp. There were, however, icons for two internet providers. This surprised him, but it was a nice surprise. He opened Firefox and typed AOL login. The blue screen came back, this time with a pulsing red circle in the middle. A soft computer voice said, "I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that." For a moment, Luke thought it was another slip-up. First Donna, then Dave, before realizing it was the voice of HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Not a goof, just geek humor, and under the circumstances, as funny as a rubber crutch. He Googled Herbert Ellis and got HAL again. Luke considered, then Googled, the Orpheum Theater on Hennepin. Not because he was planning to see a show there, or anywhere in the immediate future, it seemed, but because he wanted to know what information he could access. There had to be at least some stuff, or else why give him the connection at all? The Orf, as his parents called it, seemed to be one of the sites approved for guests of the Institute. He was informed that Hamilton was coming back, by popular demand, and Patton Oswalt would be there next month. Your sides will split. He tried Googling the Broderick School and got their website, no problem. He tried Mr. Greer, his guidance counselor, and got HAL. He was beginning to understand Dr. Dave Bowman's frustration in the movie. He started to close down, then reconsidered and typed Maine State Police into the search field. His finger hovered over the execute button, almost pressed it, then withdrew. He'd get HAL's meaningless apology, but Luke doubted if things would end with that. Very likely an alarm would go off on one of the lower levels. Not likely, surely. They might forget to change a kid's name on the computer's welcome screen, but they wouldn't forget an alert program if an Institute kid tried to contact the authorities. There would be punishment, probably worse than a slap to the face. The computer that used to belong to someone named Donna was useless. Luke sat back and crossed his arms on his narrow chest. He thought of Maureen and the friendly way she'd ruffled his hair. Only a small, absent-minded gesture of kindness, but that and the tokens had taken some of the curse off Tony's slap. Had Kalisha said the woman was $40,000 in debt? No, more like twice that. Partly because of the friendly way Maureen had touched him, and partly just to pass the time, Luke Googled, "I am overwhelmed with debt, please help." The computer immediately gave him access to all sorts of information on that subject, including a number of companies that declared clearing those pesky bills would be as easy as pie. All the back-to-the-wall debtor needed to do was make one phone call. Luke doubted it, but he supposed some folks wouldn't. It was how they got in over their heads in the first place. Maureen Alverson wasn't one of those people, though, at least according to Kalisha. She said Maureen's husband had run up the big bills before taking off. Maybe that was true, and maybe it wasn't, but either way, there would be solutions to the problem. There always were. Finding them was what learning was all about. Maybe the computer wasn't useless after all. Luke went to the sources that looked the most reliable and was soon deep in the subjects of debt and debt repayment. The old hunger to know came over him, to learn a new thing, to isolate and understand the central issues. As always, each piece of information led to three more. Or 6, or 12, and eventually a coherent picture began to emerge, a kind of terrain map. The most interesting concept, the linchpin to which all the others were attached, was simple but staggering, to Luke at least. Debt was a commodity. It was bought and sold, and at some point it had become the center of not just the American economy, but of the world's. And yet it did not really exist. It wasn't a concrete thing like gas or gold or diamonds. It was only an idea, a promise to pay. When his computer's IM chime rang, he shook his head like a boy emerging from a vivid dream. According to the computer's clock, it was almost 5 p.m. He clicked on the balloon icon at the bottom of the machine and read this. Mrs. Sigsby.
Hello, Luke. I run this joint, and I'd like to see you.
He considered this, then typed,
Do I have any choice?
The reply came at once. Mrs. Sigsby.
No.
Followed by a smiley face.
Take your smiley and stick it up your...
There was a knock at the door. He went to it, expecting Gladys, but this time it was Haddad, one of the guys from the elevator. Want to take a walk, big boy? Luke sighed.
Give me a second. I have to put on my sneakers.
No problemo.
Haddad led him to a door past the elevator and used a key card to unlock it. They walked the short distance to the administration building together, waving away the bugs. 11. Mrs. Sigsby reminded Luke of his father's oldest sibling. Like Aunt Rhoda, this woman was skinny, with barely a hint of hips or breasts. Only there were smile lines around Aunt Rhoda's mouth and always warmth in her eyes. She was a hugger. Luke thought there would be no hugs from the woman standing beside her desk in a plum-colored suit and matching heels. There might be smiles, but they would be the facial equivalent of $3 bills. In Mrs. Sigsby's eyes, he saw careful assessment and nothing else. Nothing at all.
Thank you, Haddad. I'll take it from here.
The orderly, Luke supposed that was what Haddad was, gave a respectful nod and left the office.
Let's start with something obvious, she said. We are alone. I spend 10 minutes or so alone with every new intake soon after their arrival. Some of them, disoriented and angry, have tried to attack me. I bear them no ill will for that. Why would I, for goodness sake? Our oldest intakes are 16, and the average age is 11 years and 6 months. Children, in other words. And children have poor impulse control at the best of times. I see such aggressive behavior as a teachable moment, and I teach them. Will I need to teach you, Luke?
Not about that, Luke said. He wondered if Nikki was one of those who had tried to lay hands on this trim little woman. Maybe he would ask later.
Good. Have a seat, please.
Luke took the chair in front of her desk, leaning forward with his hands clasped tightly between his knees. Mrs. Sigsby sat opposite, her gaze that of a headmistress who would brook no nonsense, who would treat nonsense harshly. Luke had never met a merciless adult, but he thought he might be facing one now. It was a frightening idea, and his first impulse was to reject it as ridiculous. He quashed it. Better to believe he had merely led a sheltered life. Better, safer to believe she was what he thought she was, unless and until she proved different. This was a bad situation. That much was beyond doubt. Fooling himself might be the worst mistake he could make.
You have made friends, Luke. That's good. A good start. You will meet others during your time in front half. Two of them, a boy named Avery Dixon and a girl named Helen Sims, have just arrived. They're sleeping now, but you'll make their acquaintance soon. Helen, perhaps before lights out at 10. Avery may sleep through the night. He's quite young, and is sure to be in an emotional state when he does wake up. I hope you will take him under your wing, as I'm sure Kalisha, Iris, and George will. Perhaps even Nick, although one never knows exactly how Nick will react, including Nick himself, I should think. Helping Avery acclimate to his new situation will earn you tokens, which, as you already know, are the primary medium of exchange here at the Institute. That is entirely up to you, but we will be watching. I know you will, Luke thought, and listening, except in the few places where you can't. Assuming Maureen's right about that. Your friends have given you a certain amount of information, some of it accurate, some of it wildly inaccurate. What I tell you now is completely accurate, so listen carefully.
She leaned forward, hands flat on her desk, her eyes locked on his.
Are your ears open, Luke? Because I do not, as the saying goes, chew my cabbage twice.
Yes.
Yes, what?
Snapping it at him, although her face remained as calm as ever.
Ears open, mind attentive. Excellent. You will spend a certain amount of time in front half. It might be 10 days. It might be 2 weeks. It might be as long as a month, although very few of our conscripts stay that long.
Conscripts? Are you saying I've been drafted?
She gave a brisk nod. I'm saying exactly that. There's a war going on, and you have been called upon to serve your country.
Why?
Because every now and then I can move a glass or a book without touching it? That's stupid.
Shut your mouth!
Almost as shocked by this as he had been by Tony's roundhouse slap, Luke did.
When I talk, you listen. You don't interrupt. Are we clear?
Not trusting his voice, Luke only nodded.
This is not an arms race, but a mind race, and if we lose, the consequences would be more than dire. They would be unimaginable. You may only be 12, but you are a soldier in an undeclared war. The same is true of Kalisha and the others. Do you like it? Of course not. Draftees never do. And draftees sometimes need to be taught that there are consequences for not following orders. I believe you've already had one lesson in that regard. If you're as bright as your records say you are, perhaps you won't need another. If you do, however, you'll get it. This is not your home. This is not your school. You will not simply be given an extra chore or sent to the principal's office or given detention. You will be punished. Clear?
Yes.
Tokens for good boys and girls. Face slaps for those who were bad. Or worse. The concept was chilling, but simple. You will be given a number of injections. You will be given a number of tests. Your physical and mental condition will be monitored. You will eventually graduate to what we call back half, and there you will be given certain services to perform. Your stay in back half may last as long as 6 months, although the average length of active service is only 6 weeks. Then your memories will be wiped, and you will be sent home to your parents.
They're alive? My parents are alive?
She laughed, the sound surprisingly merry.
Of course they're alive. We're not murderers, Luke.
I want to talk to them, then. Let me talk to them, and I'll do whatever you want.
The words were out before he realized what a rash promise this was.
No, Luke. We still don't have a clear understanding. She sat back, hands once more flat on her desk. This is not a negotiation. You will do whatever we want, regardless. Believe me on that, and spare yourself a lot of pain. You will have no contact with the outside world during your time at the Institute, and that includes your parents. You will obey all orders. You will comply with all protocols. Yet you will not, with perhaps a few exceptions, find the orders arduous or the protocols onerous. Your time will pass quickly. And when you leave us, when you wake up in your own bedroom one fine morning, none of this will have happened. The sad part, I think so anyway, is that you won't even know you had the great privilege of serving your country.
I don't see how it's possible, Luke said, speaking more to himself than to her,
which was his way when something, a physics problem,
a painting by Manet, the short and long-term implications of debt had completely engaged his attention. So many people know me. The school, the people my folks work with, my friends. You can't wipe all their memories. She didn't laugh, but she smiled.
I think you might be very surprised at what we can do. We're finished here.
She stood, came around the desk, and held out her hand.
It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Luke also stood, but he didn't take her hand.
Shake my hand, Luke.
Part of him wanted to. Old habits were hard to break. But he kept his hand at his side.
Shake it, or you'll wish you did.
I won't tell you again. He saw she absolutely meant it, so he shook her hand. She held it. Although she didn't squeeze, he could tell her hand was very strong. Her eyes stared into his.
I may see you, as another saying goes, around the campus, but hopefully this will be your only visit to my office. If you are called in here again, our conversation will be less pleasant. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good. I know this is a dark time for you, but if you do as you're told, you'll come out into the sunshine. Trust me on that. Now go.
He left, once more feeling like a boy in a dream, or Alice down the rabbit hole. Haddad was chatting with Mrs. Sigsby's secretary or assistant or whatever she was, and waiting for him.
I'll take you back to your room. Close at my side, right? No running for the trees.
They went out, started across to the residence building, and then Luke stopped as a wave of dizziness came over him.
Wait, he said. Hold on.
He bent down, grasping his knees. For a moment, colored lights swarmed in front of his eyes.
You gonna pass out? Haddad asked. What do you think?
No, Luke said. But give me a few more seconds.
Sure. You got a shot, right?
Yes.
Haddad nodded.
It hit some kids that way. Delayed reaction.
Luke expected to be asked if he saw spots or dots. But Haddad just waited, whistling through his teeth and waving at the swarming no-see-ums. Luke thought about Mrs. Sigsby's cold gray eyes and her flat refusal to tell him how a place like this could possibly exist without some form of, what would be the correct term, extreme rendition, maybe? It was as if she were daring him to do the math.
Do as you're told, you'll come out into the sunshine. Trust me on that.
He was only 12, and understood that his experience of the world was limited, but one thing he was quite sure of. When someone said, trust me, they were usually lying through their teeth.
Feeling better? Ready to go, my son?
Yes.
Luke straightened up. But I'm not your son. Haddad grinned. A gold tooth flashed.
For now you are. You're a son of the Institute, Luke. Might as well relax and get used to it.
12. Once they were inside the residence building, Haddad called the elevator, said,
see you later, alligator, and stepped in.
Luke started back to his room and saw Nikki Wilhelm sitting on the floor opposite the ice machine, eating a peanut butter cup. Above him was a poster showing two cartoon chipmunks with comic strip word balloons coming from their grinning mouths. The one on the left was saying, live the life you love. The other was saying, love the life you live. Luke stared at this, bemused.
What do you call a poster like that in a place like this, smart kid?
Nikki asked.
Irony, sarcasm, or bullshit?
All three, Luke said, and sat down beside him. Nikki held out the Reese's package. Want the other one? Luke did. He said thanks, stripped off the crinkly paper the candy sat in, and ate the peanut butter cup in three quick bites. Nikki watched him, amused.
Had your first shot, didn't you? They make you crave sugar. You may not want much for supper, but you'll eat dessert, guaranteed. Seen any dots yet?
No. Then he remembered bending over and grasping his knees while he waited for the dizziness to pass. Maybe. What are they?
The techs call them the Stasi lights. They're part of the prep. I've only had a few shots and hardly any weird tests because I'm a TK Paz. Same as George, and Shaw's TP Paz. You get more if you're just ordinary. He considered. Well, none of us are ordinary, or we wouldn't be here, but you know what I mean.
Are they trying to up our ability?
Nikki shrugged.
What are they prepping us for?
Whatever goes on in back half? How'd it go with the queen bitch? Did she give you the speech about serving your country?
She said I'd been conscripted. I feel more like I got press-ganged.
Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, see, when captains needed men to crew their ships, I know what press-gangs were, Lukey. I did go to school, you know? And you're not wrong. He got up. Come on, let's go out to the playground. You can give me another chess lesson.
I think I just want to lie down, Luke said.
You do look kind of pale. But the candy helped, right? Admit it.
It did, Luke agreed. What did you do to get a token?
Nothing. Maureen slipped me one before she went off shift. Kalisha's right about her. Nikki said this almost grudgingly. If there's one good person in this palace of shit, it's her. They had arrived at Luke's door. Nikki held up a fist, and Luke bumped it with his own.
See you when the ding-dong goes, smart kid. In the meantime, keep your pecker up.
Maureen and Avery. 1. Luke slipped into a nap crowded with unpleasant dream fragments, only waking when the ding-dong went for supper. He was glad to hear it. Nikki had been wrong. He did want to eat, and he was hungry for company as well as food. Nevertheless, he stopped in the canteen to verify that the others hadn't just been pulling his leg. They hadn't been. Next to the snack machine was a fully stocked vintage cigarette dispenser. The lighted square on top showing a man and woman in fancy dress smoking on a balcony and laughing. Next to this was a coin-op dispensing adult beverages in small bottles, what some of the booze-inclined kids at the Broad called airline nips. You could get a pack of cigarettes for 8 tokens, a small bottle of LaRue blackberry wine for 5. On the other side of the room was a bright red Coke cooler. Hands grabbed him from behind and lifted him off his feet. Luke yelled in surprise, and Nikki laughed in his ear. If you wet your pants, you must take a chance and dance to France.
Put me down.
Nikki swung him back and forth instead. Lukey titty ookie del Lukey. T-legged, toe-legged, bow-legged Lukey. He set Luke down, spun him around, raised his hands, and began to boogaloo to the muzak drifting from the overhead speakers. Behind him, Kalisha and Iris were looking on with identical boys-will-be-boys expressions.
Want to fight, Lukey? T-legged, toe-legged, bow-legged Lukey? Stick your nose up my ass and fight for air, Luke said, and began to laugh.
The word for Nikki, he thought, whether in a good mood or a bad one, was alive.
Nice one, George said, pushing his way between the two girls. I'm saving that for later use.
Just make sure I get the credit, Luke said.
Nikki quit dancing.
I'm starving, Marvin. Come on, let's eat.
Luke lifted the top of the Coke dispenser.
Soft drinks are free, I take it? You just pay for booze, smokes, and snacks.
You take it right, Kalisha said. And he pointed at the snack machine. Most of the goodies could be had for a single toke, but the one he was pointing at was a 6-token buy.
Is that? Are you asking if high boy brownies are what you think they are?
Iris asked.
I never had one myself, but I'm pretty sure they are.
Yes'm, George said. I got off, but I also got a rash. I'm allergic.
Come on, let's eat.
They sat at the same table. Norma had been replaced by Sherry. Luke ordered breaded mushrooms, chopped steak with salad, and something going under the alias of vanilla cream brulee. There might be smart people in this sinister wonderland,
Certainly Mrs. Sigsby hadn't seemed like a dummy, but whoever made out the menus was perhaps not one of them. Or was that intellectual snobbery on his part? Luke decided he didn't care. They talked a bit about their schools before they had been torn out of their normal lives. Regular schools, so far as Luke could tell, not special ones for smart kids, and about their favorite TV programs and movies. All good until Iris raised a hand to brush at one freckled cheek, and Luke realized she was crying. Not much, just a little. But yeah, those were tears.
"No shots today, but I had that damned ass temp," she said.
When she saw Luke's puzzled expression, she smiled, which caused another tear to roll down her cheek.
"They take our temperature rectally."
The others were nodding. "No idea why," George said, "but it's humiliating." "It's also 19th century," Kalisha said. "They must have some kind of reason, but..." She shrugged.
"Who wants coffee?" Nick asked. "I'll get it if you..."
"Hey."
From the doorway, they turned and saw a girl wearing jeans and a sleeveless top. Her hair, short and spiky, was green on one side and bluish-purple on the other. In spite of this punk do, she looked like a fairy tale child lost in the woods. Luke guessed she was about his age.
"Where am I? Do any of you know what this place is?"
"Come on over, sunshine," Nicky said and flashed his dazzling smile. "Drag up a rock. Sample the cuisine."
"I'm not hungry," the newcomer said. "Just tell me one thing. Who do I have to blow to get out of here?"
That was how they met Helen Sims. 2. After they ate, they went out to the playground. Luke did not neglect to slather himself with bug dope and filled Helen in. It turned out that she was a TK, and like George and Nikki, she was a pause. She proved this by knocking over several pieces on the chessboard when Nikki set them up.
"Not just paws, but awesome paws," George said. "Let me try that."
He managed to knock over a pawn, and he made the Black King rock a bit on its base, but that was all. He sat back and blew out his cheeks.
"Okay, you win, Helen."
"I think we're all losers," she said. "That's what I think."
Luke asked her if she was worried about her parents.
"Not especially. My father's an alcoholic. My mother divorced him when I was 6 and married, surprise, another alcoholic. She must have figured if you can't beat him, join him, because now she's an alky too. I miss my brother, though. Do you think he's all right?"
"Sure," Iris said, without much conviction, and then wandered away to the trampoline and began to bounce.
Doing that so soon after a meal would have made Luke feel whoopsie. But Iris hadn't eaten much.
"Let me get this straight," Helen said. "You don't know why we're here, except it maybe has something to do with psychic abilities that wouldn't even pass an America's Got Talent audition."
"Wouldn't even get us on Little Big Shots," George said.
"They test us until we see dots, but you don't know why."
"Right," Kalisha said. "Then they put us in this other place, back half, but you don't know what goes on there."
"Yep," Nikki said. "Can you play chess or just knock over the pieces?"
She ignored him. "And when they're done with us, we get some sci-fi memory wipe and live happily ever after."
"That's the story," Luke said.
She considered, then said,
"It sounds like hell."
"Well," Kalisha said,
"I guess that's why God gave us wine coolers and highboy brownies."
Luke had had enough. He was going to cry again pretty soon. He could feel it coming on like a thunderstorm. Doing that in company might be okay for Iris, who was a girl, but he had an idea, surely outdated but all the same powerful, about how boys were supposed to behave. In a word, like Nikki. He went back to his room, closed the door, and lay down on his bed with an arm over his eyes. Then, for no reason, he thought of Richie Rocket in his silver spacesuit, dancing as enthusiastically as Nikki Wilhelm had before dinner, and how the little kids danced with him, laughing like crazy and singing along to Mambo Number 5, as though nothing could go wrong, as if their lives would always be filled with innocent fun. The tears came, because he was afraid and angry, but mostly because he was homesick. He had never understood what that word meant until now. This wasn't summer camp, and it wasn't a field trip. This was a nightmare, and all he wanted was for it to be over. He wanted to wake up, and because he couldn't, he fell asleep, with his narrow chest still hitching with a few final sobs. 3. More bad dreams. He awoke with a start from one in which a headless black dog had been chasing him down Wildersmoot Drive. For a single wonderful moment, he thought the whole thing had been a dream, and he was back in his real room. Then he looked at the pajamas that weren't his pajamas, and at the wall where there should have been a window. He used the bathroom, and then, because he was no longer sleepy, powered up the laptop. He thought he might need another token to make it work, but he didn't. Maybe it was on a 24-hour cycle, or, if he was lucky, 48. According to the strip at the top, it was 3:15 in the morning. A long time until dawn, then, and what he got for first taking a nap and then falling asleep so early in the evening. He thought about going to YouTube and watching some of the vintage cartoons. Stuff like Popeye that had always had him and Rolf rolling around on the floor yelling, "Where's me spinach?" and "Uck-uck-uck." But he had an idea they would only bring the homesickness back and raving. So what did that leave? Going back to bed where he'd lie awake until daylight? Wandering the empty halls? A visit to the playground? He could do that. He remembered Kalisha saying the playground was never locked, but it would be too spooky. "Then why don't you think, asshole?" He spoke in a low voice, but jumped at the sound anyway, even half raised a hand as if to cover his mouth. He got up and walked around the room, bare feet slapping and pajama bottoms flapping. It was a good question. Why didn't he think? Wasn't that what he was supposed to be good at? Lucas Ellis, the smart kid, the boy genius, loves Popeye the Sailor Man, loves Call of Duty, loves shooting hoops in the backyard, but also has a working grasp of written French, although he still needs subtitles when he looks at French movies on Netflix, because they all talk so fast, and the idioms are crazy. Boire comme un trou, for instance. Why drink like a hole when drink like a fish makes much more sense? He can fill a blackboard with math equations. He can reel off all the elements in the periodic table. He can list every vice president going back to George Washington's. He can give you a reasonable explanation of why attaining light speed is never going to happen outside of the movies. So why is he just sitting here and feeling sorry for himself? What else can I do? Luke decided to take that as a real question instead of an expression of despair. Escape was probably impossible, but what about learning? He tried Googling the New York Times. I wasn't surprised to get HAL 9000. No news for Institute kids. The question was, could he find a way around the prohibition? A back door, maybe? Let's see, he thought. Let's just see. He opened Firefox and typed in #cloakofgriffin! Griffin was H.G. Wells's Invisible Man, and this site, which Luke had learned about a year ago, was a way to get around parental controls. Not the dark web, exactly, but next door to it. Luke had used it not because he wanted to visit porn sites on the broad's computers, although he and Rolf had done just that on a couple of occasions, or watch ISIS beheadings, but simply because the concept was cool and simple and he wanted to find out if it worked. It had at home and at school, but would it here? There was only one way to find out. So he banged the return key. The Institute's Wi-Fi munched a while. It was slow. And then, just when Luke was starting to think it was a lost cause, took him to Griffin. At the top of the screen was Wells's Invisible Man, head wrapped in bandages, badass goggles covering his eyes. Below this was a question that was also an invitation. Which language do you want translated? The list was a long one, from Assyrian to Zulu. The beauty of the site was it didn't matter which language you picked. The important thing was what got recorded in the search history. Once upon a time, a secret passage beneath parental controls had been available on Google, but the sages of Mountain View had shut it down. Hence, the Cloak of Griffin. Luke picked German at random and got Enter Password. Calling on what his dad sometimes called his weird memory, Luke typed in hashtag X49GER194Bl4. The computer munched a little more, then announced, Password accepted. He typed in New York Times and hit Enter. This time the computer thought even longer, but eventually the Times came up. Today's issue, and in English. But from this point forward, the computer search history would note nothing but a series of German words and English translations. Maybe a small victory, maybe a large one. For the moment, Luke didn't even care. It was a win, and that was enough. How soon would his captors realize what he was doing? Camouflaging the computer's search history would mean nothing if they could do live look-ins. They'd see the newspaper and shut him down. Never mind the Times with its headline about Trump in North Korea. He ought to check the Star Trib before that could happen, see if there was anything about his parents. But before he could do that, the screaming started out in the hall.
Help! 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 Somebody help me! Somebody help me! I'm lost!
4. The screamer was a little boy in Star Wars pajamas, hammering on doors with small fists that went up and down like pistons. 10? Avery Dixon looked 6, 7 at most. The crotch and one leg of his pajama pants were wet and sticking to him.
Help me! I want to go home!
Luke glanced around, expecting to see someone, maybe several someones, coming on the run, but the hall remained empty. Later, he would realize that in the Institute, a kid screaming to go home was par for the course. For the moment, Luke just wanted to shut the kid up. He was freaked out, and he was freaking Luke out. He went to him, knelt down, and took the boy by the shoulders. Hey, hey, take it easy, kid. The kid in question stared at Luke with white-ringed eyes, but Luke wasn't entirely sure the kid was seeing him. His hair was sweaty and sticking up. His face was wet with tears, and his upper lip gleamed with fresh snot.
Where's Mama? Where's Daddy?
Only it wasn't Daddy, but Daddy, like the whoop of an air raid siren. The kid began to stomp his feet. He brought his fists down on Luke's shoulders. Luke let him go, got up, and stepped back, watching with amazement as the kid fell to the floor and began to thrash. Across from the poster proclaiming this just another day in paradise, a door opened and Kalisha emerged, wearing a tie-dyed t-shirt and gigantic basketball shorts. She walked to Luke and stood looking down at the newcomer, her hands on her mostly non-existent hips. Then she looked at Luke. I've seen tantrums before, but this one takes the prize. Another door opened and Helen Sims appeared, clad, sort of, in what Luke believed were called baby doll pajamas. She had hips, plus other interesting equipment. Put your eyes back in their sockets, Lukey, Kalisha said, and help me out a little. Kids bugging my head like to give me a migraine. She knelt, reached out for the dervish, whose words had now devolved into wordless howls, and pulled back when one of his fists struck her forearm. Jesus, work with me here. Grab his hands. Luke also knelt, made a tentative move to grab the new kid's hands, pulled back, then decided he didn't want to look like a wuss in front of the lately arrived vision in pink. He grabbed the little boy at the elbows and pressed his arms to the sides of his chest. He could actually feel the kid's heart racing along at triple time. Kalisha bent over him, put her hands on the sides of his face, and looked into his eyes. The kid stopped yelling. Now there was only the sound of his rapid breathing. He looked at Kalisha, fascinated, and Luke suddenly understood what she'd meant when she said the kid was bugging her head. He's TP, isn't he? Like you. Kalisha nodded. Only he's a lot stronger than me, or any of the other TPs that have been through here during my time.
Come on, let's take him down to my room.
Can I come?
Helen asked. Suit yourself, hon, Kalisha said. I'm sure Luki here appreciates the view. Helen flushed.
Maybe I'll change first.
Do what you want, Kalisha said. Then to the kid.
What's your name?
Avery.
His voice was hoarse from crying and yelling.
Avery Dixon.
I'm Kalisha. You can call me Sha if you want.
Just don't call her Sport, Luke said.
5. Kalisha's room was more girly than Luke would have expected, given her tough talk. There was a pink spread on the bed, and frou-frou flounces on the pillows. A framed picture of Martin Luther King stared at them from the bureau. She saw Luke looking at it and laughed. They try to make things the same as at home, but I guess someone thought the picture I used to have there was taking it a little too far. So they changed it.
Who did it used to be?
Eldridge Cleaver. Ever heard of him?
Sure.
Soul on Ice? I haven't read it, but I've been meaning to get around to it. She raised her eyebrows.
Man, you are wasted here.
Still sniffling, Avery started to get up on her bed. But she grabbed him and pulled him back, gently but firmly.
Nuh-uh, not in those wet pants.
She made as if to take them off, and Avery stepped back, hands crossed protectively over his crotch. Kalisha looked at Luke and shrugged. He shrugged back, then squatted in front of Avery.
Which room are you in?
Avery only shook his head.
Did you leave the door open?
This time the kid nodded.
I'll get you some dry clothes, Luke said. You stay here with Kalisha, okay?
No shake and no nod this time. The boy only stared at him, exhausted and confused, but at least not doing his air raid imitation anymore.
Go on,
Kalisha said.
I think I can soothe him down.
Helen appeared at the door, now wearing jeans and buttoning up a sweater.
Is he any better?
A little, Luke said. He saw a patter of drops tending in the direction he and Maureen had gone to change the sheets.
No sign of the other two boys, Helen said. They must sleep like the dead.
They do, Kalisha said. You go on with Luke, new girl. Avery and I are having a meeting of the minds here. 6.
The kid's name is Avery Dixon, Luke said as he and Helen Sims stood in an open door just past the ice machine, which was clattering away to itself.
He's 10. Doesn't look it, does he?
She stared at him, eyes wide.
What are you, TP after all?
No.
Surveying the poster of Tommy Pickles and the G.I. Joes on the bureau.
I was here with Maureen. She's one of the housekeepers. I helped her change the bed. Other than that, the room was all ready for him.
Helen smirked.
So that's what you are, teacher's pet.
Luke thought of Tony slapping him across the face and wondered if Helen would soon be getting the same treatment.
No, but Maureen's not like some of the others. Treat her right, and she'll treat you right.
How long have you been here, Luke?
I got here just before you.
So how do you know who's nice and who isn't?
Maureen's okay, that's all I'm saying. Help me get him some clothes.
Helen grabbed some pants and underwear out of the dresser, not neglecting to snoop her way through the rest of the drawers. And they walked back to Kalisha's room. On the way, Helen asked if Luke had had any of the tests Georgia told her about. He said he hadn't, but showed her the chip in his ear.
Don't fight it. I did, and got whacked.
She stopped dead.
Shut up!
He turned his head to show her his cheek, where two of Tony's fingers had left faint bruises.
No one's whacking me, Helen said.
That's a theory you don't want to test.
She tossed her two-tone hair.
My ears are pierced already, so no big deal.
Kalisha was sitting on her bed with Avery beside her, his butt on a folded towel. She was stroking his sweaty hair. He was looking up at her dreamily as if she were Princess Tiana. Helen tossed Luke the clothes. He wasn't expecting it and dropped the underpants, which were imprinted with pictures of Spider-Man in various dynamic poses.
I have no interest in seeing that kid's teeny peeny. I'm going back to bed. Maybe when I wake up, I'll be in my room, my real room, and all of this will have just been a dream.
Good luck with that, Kalisha said.
Helen strode away. Luke picked up Avery's underwear just in time to mark the swing of her hips in the faded jeans.
Yummy, huh?
Kalisha's voice was flat. Luke brought her the clothes, feeling his cheeks heat.
I guess so, but she leaves something to be desired in the personality department.
He thought that might make her laugh. He liked her laugh, but she looked sad. This place will knock the bitch out of her. Pretty soon she'll be scurrying and flinching every time she sees a guy in a blue top, just like the rest of us.
Avery, you need to get dressed in these things. Me and Lukey will turn our backs.
They did so, staring out Kalisha's open door at the poster proclaiming this was paradise. From behind them came sniffling and rustling clothes. At last, Avery said,
I'm dressed. You can turn around.
They did. Kalisha said,
Now take those wet PJ pants into the bathroom and hang them over the side of the tub.
He went without argument, then shuffled back.
I did it, Shaw.
The fury was gone from his voice. Now he sounded timid and tired.
Good for you. Go on and get back on the bed. Lie down. It's okay.
Kalisha sat, dropped Avery's feet on her lap, then patted the bed next to her. Luke sat down and asked Avery if he was feeling better.
I guess so.
You know so,
Kalisha said, and began to stroke the little boy's hair again. Luke had a sense, maybe bullshit, maybe not, that a lot was going on between them, inside traffic.
Go on, then, Kalisha said. Tell him your joke if you have to, then go to fucking sleep.
You said.